On this latest episode of Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks, we've got some beautiful new HP Elite books, a smoking hot Apple MacBook, literally, a gorgeous Asus G-Sync display, 4K, 144 hertz, and a whole lot more. Welcome back, everybody. This is Marco Cipetta from Hot Hardware. This is 2.5 Geeks, though today we're sans one of the main geeks. Dave is not around today, but we are blessed with Chris and Brittany Getting. Britt and Chris, how you guys doing today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good.
I can't complain. It's a little hot in here. I'm getting a little sweaty, and being a host, I'm a little nervous, but I think we're going to do okay. So yeah, there's been a whole bunch going on the past couple of weeks. We posted a few reviews, lots of interesting hot news going on the site. I'm going to kick it off to Chris and Brittany to start. We just posted a review of two brand new HP Elite books powered by Intel hardware. Chris, why don't you tell everybody about them?
Yeah, so the other Chris took a look at these. So HP sent over the Elite book 830 and 840 for him to take a look at. Those are the 13.3 and 14 inch models of the new EliteBook G5. So this is representing obviously their very premium lineup, something like, you know, Dell's XPS or the ThinkPads. So it's all aluminum chassis now. I think it was a magnesium alloy before. All new eighth gen Core i7-8650U in both of the models as we have it configured, with 16 gigs of RAM and a half terabyte SSD. So these are definitely packing a lot of heat under them. HP looked to upgrade a number of things with it, from the visual redesign with the new aluminum chassis. They also upgraded the speaker system in it, so you've got a much better quality audio on board with
now,
a
lot. Were you able to flip through and kind of dissect the numbers? I know you didn't write it, but have you taken a look at the numbers? How did the machines sort of stack up versus other machines in the class?
Yeah, so performance-wise, it did quite well. The only machine that really seems to beat it in its class is the XPS 13, which is frankly an over-engineered laptop. I don't expect anything to come close to that. But compared to, say, other notebooks like the ThinkPad X1 Carbon or the Latitude 7390 we looked at with the same 8650U CPU, it came out well ahead of those. So definitely better thermal performance, so it's able to keep running at its full clock speed for longer, which is always nice to see, especially when we're getting down into those 13-inch form factors where everything's very, very cramped. In the graphic side of things, it has the Intel HD graphics, so we're not expecting anything spectacular from it. But again, it's performing right in line with where we expect, kind of upper end of the pack of the i7 Ultrabook chips. And then when we get into the battery life side of things, we see that it has pretty good numbers. So you're looking at 6 to 7 hours of video playback, according to our benchmark, which is pretty good. It's nothing that's going to be mind-blowing, again, like the XPS 13 managed to be, but it's still going to get you through most of a workday just fine. So should be plenty decent for travel. And even under load with the battery eater test, it didn't seem to suffer as much as some other notebooks have. So it's right in the healthy 2 to 3 hour range. And that's, you know, full out CPU, GPU load, everything you can throw at it.
HP seemed to hit a nice balance with these machines. I was, you know, I edited the piece, I helped Dave edit the piece before it went up, and they seem just basically all around lots of connectivity, beautiful rigid chassis. The design language is the same. The two models that Chris L looked at, they're identical internal hardware, just different screen sizes. This style of machine, do you like what HP's done with sort of the super clean look, the new kind of edgy logo? Do you dig the machine?
Yeah, well, I really like the solid aluminum cast design or milled aluminum design. I find it to be very durable. I'm not worried about dropping it and causing damage. You don't have to worry about fingerprints with it. So it looks nice out of the box and it stays nice, which is always really good to see, especially when you're in the business world with these and appearances matter. So very nice look. They're great looking laptops. I wish I could see one in person.
They're very sleek.
Yeah. And the other thing is they do have the slim side bezels, which I like to see. The top bezel is still a bit thicker so that they can squeeze the webcam in there. But considering they have things like a quick access button for Skype and things that they intend this to be for people who are going to be video conferencing a lot. So it's a wise move, I think, to keep the webcam up top, even if you are dealing with a slightly larger bezel than you would with something like the XPS.
Yeah, it seems like they made some really good design choices on this. And pricing was kind of wild, too. Like the models that we looked at were, you know, north of $1,900, but there were really high-end configs. HP offers a wide range of configurations for these machines and actually start under $900 for a premium, really good-looking notebook. Real nice machines as far as I could tell. Again, I didn't have my hands on them either. One of our other writers did the review, but seemed like really attractive, nice-looking machines. And speaking of other attractive, nice-looking machines, we had some news on a 2018 MacBook that had issues with a certain Intel processor. Chris, why don't you fill everybody in on this one? Because you mentioned thermals on the EliteBook were good, but it seems like Apple's got a problem, right?
Right. So this is kind of one of those you always need to look past the spec sheets kind of things to see how it's actually running. So the new MacBook with the Core i9 on board, based on some testing we're seeing, some reporting from David Lee, a YouTuber, it looks like the Core i9 inside is really starved thermally, and it's not even able to hit its base clock speeds, not even talking to thermal clocks, turbo clock speeds, but it's not even able to hit the 2.9 gigahertz base clock speed with all cores running. I mean, it does have six cores, but you know, what's the point of having a six core chip when it can't even hit its base clocks because the thermals are engineered evidently so inefficiently that it can't keep it cool. So if you take a look at the article we have up, you can see the inside of the notebook. There is a dual blower fan setup, but only a single heat pipe. So I'm not sure if that's where the issue is, just not able to transfer out the heat quickly enough to stay under load. Maybe Apple is just being too aggressive with their throttling on it. But it seems like there's just not enough there to keep the chip happy. I mean, if you're doing very light workloads and it's still probably going to boost up just fine for quick tasks. But when you're doing something like a video render or something that's going to take a while and, you know, be abusing your cores for a while, it's a bit iffy on the thermals.
And yeah. It's actually something that's confusing for lots of consumers. You might see 2, 3, 4 notebooks, all similar price, all similar size, all with identical specs, and they might perform the same on the first benchmark run in a particular benchmark, but run that benchmark a whole bunch of times, keep the machine under load, and the engineering of the cooling solution matters because these modern chips, they clock dynamically, voltages and frequencies throttle dynamically based on load and thermals, and you might have one machine that can maintain its performance the whole time and another that can't. And I mean, this could be a fluke with the machine on YouTube. I haven't seen widespread issues. Maybe it is now that this news is sort of a hit, that other people are clamoring that this particular MacBook has issues. But yeah, man, that's a lot of compute horsepower to have in a really thin chassis.
Yeah. So, I mean, the sample size is a big thing. So maybe if we see more than, you know, a couple units with the same issues, we can officially say it's a problem, but it's not looking good at this point. But it is also something that we've seen even with the i7-8650U that's in the EliteBook there. The Dell Latitude 7390 that I took a look at a while back, with the same 8650U, had probably 15 to 20% less performance out of the same chip just because it wasn't able to keep it cool.
Yep, that's that's something that more people totally, totally need to understand. We actually just got a comment too from Michael Mitchell in the chat. It says, wait till some dust gets in there. So yeah, this is could also be an issue that crops up more and more as some of these high-end machines that are sort of on that bleeding edge. You know, you're going to have to maintain the machine. It's going to get filled with dust. The thermal paste is going to, you know, break down over time, and you might have throttling later, even if it, you know, it's just right there on the edge now. Definitely something to consider. Chris, anything else we should add to that story before we move on?
I mean, just a consideration that, you know, as we have these thin and light devices, that there is diminishing returns to how much you can get out of it thermally. So, you know, maybe an i5 doesn't look so bad in one of these ultrabooks if you're going to be limited by that thermal threshold anyways.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you're a user that's not running crazy multi-threaded workloads. If you're browsing the web and working in Office most of the time, probably better going with a lower-end chip and getting better battery life than worrying about one of these super high-end machines. So I think we're going to move on to something really high-end and amazing, something that people have been waiting quite a long time to check out, and we finally got one in hand. So back at CES 2017, we showed a couple of NVIDIA G-Sync 4K 144 hertz displays, one from ASUS, one from Acer. And now, you know, here we are a year and a half later, they've finally shipped. And they're super pricey, but these monitors are nuts. We got a chance to look at the ASUS ROG Swift PG27UQ. That's the model number. Now, this is a 27-inch 4K display, high-end panel with NVIDIA G-Sync and HDR support. Now, overall, if you were to kind of poll hardcore gamers on the things, or even just a high-end enthusiast, what are the most impressive specs you'd want in a display? They're going to tell you they want high resolution, they want a high refresh rate, they want HDR support, they want things like local dimming, they want a cool chassis, maybe some extra features. You know, I like the idea of back bias lighting. ASUS didn't quite do a standard back bias lighting, but it has built-in lighting. And all of this culminates in a display that costs $2,000. So this is not a cheap monitor, but it's really the pinnacle of gaming monitors. Now, in terms of ghosting and playing games on it, so Paul wrote this review, and in watching HDR YouTube videos, playing games, Netflix HDR watching in 4K on here, the monitor performed, you know, incredibly. He says it, and in like sort of off the cuff conversations before this review went live, he was comparing it to the monitors he's owned previously, and he's like, it's head and shoulders better than everything else that he's tested. In terms of its specifications, so I've already mentioned the 4K and the refresh rate. It's with 1,000:1 static contrast ratio. But this display, and I think I'm going to forget how many zones it has, but it has something like 384 zones for local dimming. So there are, instead of a single backlight, there are different zones that can be dimmed so you can get greater contrast in light and dark areas. You know, a light area of a scene can be brightly lit while the backlight's off in a dark area. So you get that really, you know, wide contrast in sort of real world use. Really, the only issues that Paul came across, this monitor is actually actively cooled. So there's a fan inside there. There's a lot of tech in this monitor. It's probably, you know, the reason that it took so long to come out. You know, this is a bleeding edge monitor in every sense of the word. So there's active cooling in the display, and you can hear sort of a slight fan whir. It's not completely silent like most displays are. And HDR support is not quite fully mature on a Windows desktop. There, it works. There weren't any crazy issues, but in this particular setup, some SDR games were perhaps a little darker than they would have looked on a standard display. Other minor things that you have to sort of tweak in Windows, like to turn HDR on and off and to set different brightness levels for SDR and HDR, things like that. And ASUS actually has a firmware fix on the way that's probably, in addition to what Microsoft is working on in Windows, ASUS has a firmware fix coming to address some other minor issues, but it's not user serviceable yet. That's going to come in a few months. But overall, just killer, sick, high-end display, wide color support, you name the gaming feature, it has it. Chris, what do you think of this thing?
Oh, It's absolutely gorgeous. I wish it was sitting here on my desk. Right. You know, I see it was a 27-inch panel, which I know you said before you think is a little small. I think 27 is probably about right. So you're either going to like that or not like that. But 4K, high refresh rate, overclockable to 144 hertz, G-Sync and HDR. I mean, it really checks off any wish list that anyone could reasonably have right now. I know there's been 8K panels out, but you're not going to get high refresh rate out of that anytime soon. It'll be nice when it comes, but for right now, this is like the dream panel to have.
From the it's 7. Awesome. So speaking of like an 8K panel, that requires multi-stream transport. So the monitor that I'm sitting in front of right now is one of the first high-end 4K panels, and it requires MST, multi-stream transport over DisplayPort, to work properly. It basically is detected as two separate displays, and the single cable is kind of stitching the two displays together over one. There are some weird issues with a setup like this, and people with 8K displays have to deal with that right now. Now, this particular display, this is kind of actually a good segue to a couple other points. Let me go back to the page that had this. So because this is a DisplayPort 1.4 and it's not using MST, it's, you know, there's only a certain amount of bandwidth over that cable that you can have. So this display can do 98 hertz with 444 and 10-bit color compression, or 120 hertz RGB 444 with 8-bit color depth, or 144 hertz YCBCR 422 at an 8-bit color depth. So, and that's for SDR content. For HDR content, actually, I think HDR content's the same, except the 144 hertz YCBCR 422 can also do 10-bit. So they're basically saturating the amount of data that can come over that cable to feed this display the images that it's showing. So that just goes to show you that we need graphics cards with newer display standards to kind of push better quality than this display kind of offers. That's how high end it is. But, you know, $2,000 is not cheap. $2,000 for it. Now, you mentioned the 27-inch too. The display I'm in front of is a 32-inch right now. For a single display, right, the way my brain works, 32-inch is too big. 27-inch is too small. My favorite display ever, and I kind of wish I never got rid of it, was my 30-inch, I forget the model, 30-inch HP 2560 by 1600. That was just the most trouble-free, you know, not high enough res where you need crazy graphics cards to run it, but not low enough where pixel density sucks, no weird issues with cables. You can use, you know, whatever cable you wanted with that thing, you know, as long as it was digital and it just sort of worked. None of these new ones are quite at that stage, but yeah, this thing is nuts, man. I wish I had the money to buy one.
Well, when you're on the bleeding edge, there's going to be sacrifices to make. So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think we sort of, beat this one, to death here. Do we have any questions? No, Craig just says hi from the chat, but no questions on the display. Hi, if you want to see, you know, more examples of how that monitor performed in the actual review, Chris has pictures of viewing angles and screenshots of some of the tests and all of the on-screen menus and all of the stuff that you can see sort of when you're configuring it on screen. That stuff is all posted in the full review, so make sure you come by the site and check that out. But I think we're going to move on. Chris, we had some news hit about a potential new Intel Coffee Lake chip coming, right? Why don't you tell everybody about that?
Yeah, so if you're hoping to hear about 10-nanometer Cannon Lake, I don't have news for you. But pressing on with Coffee Lake, we have a refresh coming up, like we saw with Cable Lake refresh, etc. So kind of extending that 14-nanometer out just a little more. So this is going into the 9th-gen core chips, and we are looking at three options so far. The Core i9-9900K, which is going to be the, I guess, flagship 8-core 16 threads, or I presume flagship. There will also be the Core i7-9700K, which is 6 cores and 12 threads, as well as the i5-9600K with 6 cores and no hyper-threading, so just 6 threads with that. We're seeing some clock speeds come out, at least for the 9600K, which is going to be at a base clock of 3.7 gigahertz to a turbo of 4.5 gigahertz. So nothing too crazy there, but there are some rumors coming through PC Builders Club that they may be able to overclock incredibly well with murmurs of 5.5 gigahertz, I presume single core clocks, being achievable. Whether we need to get out our big grain of salt for that or not, probably. There's a lot in play with it. So, you know, as you know, with the Intel chips, they've kind of been nagged for a long time about their thermal interface material being not good. So there's rumors that we could be seeing a return to a soldered interface there, which should transfer heat better and give a little more thermal headroom, make it dissipate heat a little better to keep the higher clocks stable. I don't think we have any confirmation of that yet. So it's, again, grain of salt. We don't really know, but it is hopefully promising that the high-end chips are going to get rid of the crappy thermal interface material that they've been using, and get back to a proper soldered solution. Do you know anything more that I've skipped over here?
Not really. What I was actually going to ask, and I was trying to look it up while you were chatting, and I didn't find it yet. This obviously is either this is actually sort of the key to the whole story. This is either a new die, right? Because it's an 8-core, or it's something repurposed from the Xeons that were based on these. So with the existing Coffee Lake stuff, I think that 5.5 gigahertz is probably BS. I have an 8086K here, and I didn't do anything crazy like delit it and, change the thermal interface material or even try to do any direct die cooling. But there was no way it was doing 5.5. I published the review, and I think I had it at 5.1 or 5. 5.1 was stable. 5.2 booted. I couldn't run every benchmark at 5.2. But I'm a psycho, right? So I got the chip for review. It's not like it was money out of my pocket. So pumping 1.6 volts through it, I was going to give it a shot. And even with a big liquid cooler with some packs of frozen peas on top of everything to get temps as low as I could just quickly for giggles and a ton of voltage, I couldn't get it stable at 5.2. So if they're going to hit 5.5, oh, go ahead, sir.
What kind of power delivery were you giving it at 5.2?
So it's funny. At 5.1, I think I added something like 100 watts to the load, just overclocking at 5.1. 5.2, I couldn't get it stable enough long enough to get a real reading, but the voltage was so high, it was going to be even more. I was cranking a ton of voltage through it. So that's obviously all going to scale linearly based on how much voltage you're pumping through there. So, but going back to this story, if it's going to hit 5.5, it's not the same. It's not the same die, obviously, because it's an 8-core. But Intel would have to have made, not only would most likely have to replace that TIM with something better, there would have to be changes to the design and maybe perhaps a new stepping, tweaks to the chip to get it to hit those clocks. And I'm not sure they're doing that with this. I think it's more like repurposing a Xeon. So Intel has mainstream 8-cores to battle the 8-core Ryzen. Sort of in the same arena. Going to be interesting. I personally can't really, I'm not under NDA, so I haven't heard of these specifically yet. So I don't know if they're definitely coming. It seems like August release for these would be too fast, considering it's already mid-July, but this is a new Intel right now. The CEO's gone. I've heard some rumblings of some changes internally, trying to maybe be more enthusiast PC friendly again. We'll see. There was lots of talk of drones for a long time. And, I love to tell the story of the last IDF I went to and watching the keynote. And through this huge long keynote, I think I saw 1 minute of talk on processors and a bunch of IoT and drone talk for the rest of it. I'm like, what conference am I at? Is this Intel? So, I think they're going to head in another direction, which is good. But the news on this one, this is going to be interesting to see how it plays out. I mean, this is obviously a play to battle Ryzen, and competition is good. So we'll see how this goes. Did I miss anything?
Because we also just saw news that PC sales are actually going back up. So at least in the high-end space, I don't know if we had an article on that, but it is at least promising that, you know, we've got AMD back in the ring with their Ryzen chips doing great things. Now we've got, you know, Intel hopefully making this return towards enthusiast friendly chips. So, I mean, it's a wait and see scenario, but I'll be optimistic.
Yeah, when the whole smartphone tablet thing was going to kill the PC hit, I think if you went back to every podcast, I made fun of everybody that said it's going to kill the PC because it just didn't make sense. If literally your workday just revolves around reading emails and responding with a couple of lines, maybe a tablet and a smartphone is going to kill a PC. But you know, now that we see that tablets have sort of, you know, petered out and news is sort of hitting that, you know, even the cell phone market is starting to be flat. All of a sudden, hey, look, these innovative. I mean, it's great that it sort of pushed PC people to innovate because 10 years ago, 8 years ago, we had some real crappy mobile devices. Notebooks kind of sucked. Netbooks sucked. And now we've got lots of beautiful machines to choose from. So it was good that this sort of lit a fire under the PC industry's butt. And we have lots of nice things to choose from. And, you know, two-in-ones are really where it's at right now if you're looking at a mobile device. You know, your phone is a utility now, but your work device is a two-in-one for most people. Yeah, so I'm not surprised to see the PC industry coming back a little bit. I was saying it for a long time. I thought Windows 10 was going to be the linchpin because between Windows 8 and crappy devices, that was not good news. It didn't happen quite with Windows 10, but we're getting there.
Yeah. Well, we'll ask the PhD candidate here how she feels about the prospect of writing a dissertation on a cell phone.
No. Oh, my goodness. Well, also, too, for those who don't know my entire life story, I am a PhD candidate and an educator by day. And so I'm often in a classroom. And the students don't use their phones and tablets to write notes, right? Or they bring their laptops with them. And so I think overall, tablets and mobile devices just aren't super practical in a classroom environment, especially, or even in a business environment. If you're doing a lot of typing, you just can't get that speed and accuracy and mobility that you can really get from a laptop.
Right. Yeah. And where I work, our traveling salespeople, they're not asking for tablets. Nope. I mean, they'll have email on their cell phone, but you better believe they still have a laptop with them.
Right.
So PCs are far from dead.
And you know, the touch interfaces were touch interfaces are there. It's useful in a certain form factor. Right. But other conversations I had, you know, when this thing was breaking, you know, back then when tablets were the new hot thing, when the iPad was new and hot, was if something is not more productive than a mouse and keyboard, then the mouse and keyboard are not going to get replaced. You know, right. So that's why desktops will always have a place, not always, but you know, will have a place for a long time to come, notebooks as well. If you really got to get down to business, you need a way to interface quickly and efficiently, and mouse and keyboard are still kind of where it's at. And you want the horsepower of a, you know, a higher end machine too. Agreed?
That helps.
Oh yeah. Speaking of higher end, you want to go on to our next talk?
Yeah, so I'll move on. So we're going to talk about something else. Intel, this is the headline that we have is kind of a happier headline than what I think the more interesting story is here. So Intel and Micron announced a partnership for second-gen 3D cross-point memory to further advance Optane storage. So if you are a regular reader and you follow the storage space, you know that Intel's Optane drives are sort of where it's at for high-performance storage on the PC. Whether it's a caching solution like Optane Memory that will accelerate a slower drive, a standalone Optane SSD, even something, you know, high-end like the Optane SSD, the 905, the most recently released high-end model. Basically, all of the Optane devices, they're not class-leading across the board. They're not kings of sequential transfers. But at low queue depths and with small file transfers, specifically 4K transfers, where lots of the workload happens on a typical consumer PC, they just blow everything out of the water. You'll see transfer rates 2, 3, 5 times the speed of some even, you know, high-end NAND SSDs. So Intel and Micron worked together to develop the 3D cross-point memory used on Optane, and they've been doing that for years. You know, the breakthrough came a few years ago when they first announced the official name 3D cross-point, and they've been collaborating continually, and they've announced that they're going to continue collaborating to finish developing the second-gen 3D cross-point memory, which we can only assume is going to be higher capacity, lower latency, and more performance, which we all want. But after that, the partnership is ending. So in 2019, they believe the second gen stuff, that the development will be complete in the first half of 2019. And then after that, Intel and Micron are going their separate ways. They're going to continue development on 3D crosspoint memory types. But apparently the companies have sort of different directions that they want to follow, and they're going to break off and do their own development for that stuff. Do you sort of read the same thing that I do from the story, Chris, Britt? What do you think?
Yeah,
I think so.
So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how standards develop out of it after they split ways, but hopefully there's a solid enough foundation there that, you know, you're not going to have things diverging into different interfaces and all kinds of other proprietary stuff that nobody wants.
Right.
I wouldn't say nobody wants. So looking at 3D crosspoint, right? I know consumers want it easy, but looking long term with 3D crosspoint, this is the stuff that could like literally change the PC architecture, in my opinion. I'm probably more pie in the sky than most people, but Intel could theoretically, you know, replace a regular standard memory controller with some sort of, you know, high speed, really wide, Optane or 3D crosspoint compatible controller. We do away with SDRAM, do away with NAND flash, and you just have one big giant pool of fast, non-volatile, low latency storage for everything. So, terabytes of space for an OS or storage that could be sort of dynamically allocated as needed. I think that's where it could be headed.
Yeah. So we've seen the DIMMs with Optane on them. I don't know if anything of too crazy has come out of that yet, but those still have that onboard DDR memory that's kind of cashing in, I guess you could say. But that's definitely a direction it's going, which also why they named the caching solution Optane memory when they have the DIMM option with Optane, I don't know. But
It was an interesting marketing decision. Optane memory, it's Optane memory in an M.2 stick. It was sort of confusing. I agree with you there. It's really because you can still use those Optane memory sticks as a standalone SSD. They're just really small capacity, you know, 16 gig, 32 gig. And the most recent one we looked at, I think we talked about it one or two podcasts ago, was a 64 gig. If you want an Optane SSD, they're higher capacity, also much more money. But yeah, they're definitely not the cheapest options. Optane devices or devices based on 3D crosspoint memory are like 2 to 3x, if I'm remembering correctly, in terms of cost per gigabyte, than even the best NAND solutions out there right now. But really, it's such a really cool technology. You know, that Intel and Micron. I'm sorry, I missed that. What was that?
We're very early in Optane, so you know. SSDs, whether they're NAND or whatever, I guess they would be NAND. I mean, SATA or NVMe are pretty well mature at this point. So those costs are down, production's up. So we can expect costs to drop on Optane as well to compete. There is that early adopter tax to it right now. But it'll get there.
Yeah.
The industry always seems to find a way.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Even though it's been, you know, we've been hearing about 3D crosspoint for some time, products based on it are relative to other storage solutions. They're really, really new. It's definitely a fledgling tech, but it's a really interesting, cool tech that could revolutionize things long-term. I guess we'll see. But instead of looking to the future, why don't we look to a new product that sort of breathes new life into something from the past. There was these really cool 8-bit do-it-yourself kits or something like that. I think, Brittany, you wrote about it. What were these things?
I wrote about this yesterday. So 8-bit do is mostly known for creating basically retro controllers. And now they're actually selling do-it-yourself kits that will transform your NES, your SNES, your Mega Genesis or Mega Drive controllers into wireless. And the really neat things about this is you don't really need a ton of know-how to put them together. The kits come with all of the supplies in them, so you don't have to like go searching in your garage for that one tool that you use once a year to, you know, create whatever it is that you do. And the kits, what they do is they take the basically the hole where the cable is, and they turn that into a charger. So there'll be like a little light where you can see how much your controller is charged, or whether or not it's actually actively connected to your console or laptop. And then they use Bluetooth basically to connect with a wide variety of devices. I believe it is. They're compatible with Android 4.0 and above, Windows 7 and above. They're also compatible with Raspberry Pi and Nintendo Switch, which for with the Nintendo Switch market the way it is, this is really great news if you still love to use your retro controllers. They also have been known to release other items. They have a slew of things that they're going to be releasing, a slew of other controllers that will be released during the holidays. But this is this will be an interesting thing to do, especially if you are looking for a do-it-yourself kit or want to do something with your controllers. Maybe you've been irritated by that cable for a long time, and now there's a $20 solution out there for you.
Now, so this isn't, I'm not completely well versed on this. This isn't something where if you have an NES controller and an original console, you can now convert it to wireless. This is for people who are into retro gaming on newer devices and want to use the old retro controllers, but make them wireless, correct?
Yes.
That's pretty cool. So
it is. It's really cool. The thing is, if you do want to use it with an NES, you would need to get some sort of Bluetooth adapter. So it's not going to then work wirelessly with your, you know, old NES, with the classic consoles. But if you are looking, so you have to figure out a way to do that yourself. But if you're looking for a way to use those controllers while you're playing with your Nintendo Switch or something like that, this is a really cool solution.
Right. Virtual that console. Is cool.
We got a question in the chat, and I'm not sure if we know based on the information that's out there. Do they come with the charger? Do you have to provide your own micro USB charger? Do we know?
I know they charge. They do come with a battery. I'm actually not entirely certain if they come with that. Is a good question. I would bet
for $20 that they don't. That would be my bet. Yeah, lots of companies are starting to do that.
Right. Would be my bet. I
kind of assume you're going to have mini or micro USB cables around.
Yeah, I don't quote me on that. I don't remember seeing that information on there. But yeah, like you said, I would assume for the price, it probably doesn't include it. So
did you mention how much they are? How much are they?
$19.99.
So that's cool. So
yeah,
I was going to say, so for $20, you basically get a whole PCB. And you just sort of swap the guts and you have a wireless controller on one of these based on one of these retro designs?
Yeah, basically. Yep. And they do also awesome. One nice thing on their website is they do provide sort of a how-to video. So if you receive it and you're still kind of uncertain, you know, how to proceed, they do have that additional information there. So for $20, I mean, if this is your thing, it's pretty cool. And you know, the price isn't half bad.
Well, you know this is my thing.
Right.
So yeah,
when have you ever been known for retro gaming?
Right, when has Marco ever been known for that?
It's not like I love retro stuff at all. So yeah, right. This looking at these things, it like immediately reminds me of. So, as if you're a regular viewer or a regular reader of the site, you know I'll take any excuse to talk about Commodore and the Amiga and the C64, and these sort of controllers, being able to use them with a Pi is awesome, because you know we have a couple of articles up on the site. I did an article on emulating the Commodore 64 with a Pi Zero, and also did it was really popular the article on emulating the Amiga with the Raspberry Pi 3. And it's really super easy. All of the software that I featured in those articles has been updated, and it's, you know, it's even more compatible and easier to do it now than when those original pieces were published. And for very little money, you could have, you know, the Raspberry Pi is many times more powerful than these older machines were. You know, they were based on, you know, 30-year-old tech. So you can have a really cool small form factor, and you know, these really cool 3D printed cases to even make them look good. I had little Commodore and Amiga cases 3D printed that look awesome, and you pair it to one of these controllers, and I mean, you really have the full retro experience without having to have the big old retro hardware around. I right. think these kits are really interesting. I'm gonna have to buy some of these
now. With those Did you find any issues with input lag on them? Because I know with a number of the projects that people do complain about having lag with emulated games versus saying native on the Commodore or Amiga, whatever, what have you.
I didn't. I did have to go through. What I did find was that controllers, if you're buying stuff on Amazon or eBay, whatever, you'll see these retro controllers that say they're Pi compatible, but they work like on the PC. They're standard USB controllers, but they didn't always work on the Pi. So I did have to go through a couple of these random off brands to get ones that worked. But I didn't have any real input lag at all. What I do find more are like weird graphical anomalies, things that don't, obviously all those old machines were on connected to 4:3 displays and we're all on 16:9 or 16:10 now. So not everything would scale right, or things would not look right. Even if you set the emulators to a certain res and, a certain window size, it wasn't always perfect, and they're not emulating all of the tech perfectly, so it's not 100% compatible. But yeah, the controllers weren't an issue for me though.
But it's about the experience and the nostalgia, right?
Right.
I want to say yes. I'd really, it's really just the nostalgia, to be perfectly honest, because a lot of the old stuff, it doesn't hold up. It really doesn't hold up. I remember watching some videos and demos back in the day and listening to some music on these old PCs that back then it was crazy. So cool. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then you watch it again now and it's like, oh my God, that's so bad. I'm going to give you just a quick example before we wrap up. Just today, in my normal jaunt across my various groups to see what's happening in the retro scene, somebody had posted, I think, I might be wrong on this. I don't know if it's Bruce Lee's birthday or something related to Bruce Lee today, but somebody posted a long play through the Bruce Lee game on the Commodore 64. And I remember loving this game on the C64. And I went and just kind of fast forwarded through the game and went all the way to the ending. And it was so bad. It's so bad. Like, how did I spend so many hours playing this stupid game? So yeah, it's really just the nostalgia. What with the Commodore 64 and the Amiga for me, because at the time they were both really advanced, especially the Amiga. It was one of those things where you were kind of were hoping it would take off, because what are people not seeing? Like, how is the community not seeing how great this is? Why is it getting killed by these other machines? And, I didn't understand business back then, It was Commodore killing the company. But yeah, it's definitely just nostalgia and it's fun. I can't believe how much time I waste looking at retro repairs and retro builds on YouTube. It's crazy. And I really have to blame Chris for turning me on to the 8-bit guy. Because I'm literally, as soon as I get a notification from the 8-bit guy, I have to go watch the damn video. Mm-hmm.
But his videos are fantastic, I have to say. If you've never checked out the 8-bit guy on YouTube, he does really great stuff, all retro stuff, as his name implies.
Right.
But he does teardowns, rebuilds, a bit of programming tricks they did. He had some videos on old video cameras that were shooting with like cassette tapes or CDs that were absolutely fascinating. Just all kinds of old nostalgic tech, if that's what you're into.
I believe we featured him a couple of times on the website as well. So go ahead and check that out too. But I think the great thing that 8-bit Do is doing right now is like there's such a market for this. Like Marco, you're kind of the example. But I mean, overall, I think that reliving the experience of those original machines, I mean, they're people want to do that, especially as the machines progress and, now we're looking at those big AAA games. It's sort of nice to kind of go back.
Right. And they want to share with their kids, games. Hey, this right, is what I grew up with. Right. And
yeah,
as an
that's actually one of the reasons that I enjoyed doing it so much is my older daughter. She sort of gets into it as much as I do. She's so cute. It's awesome. She's actually said to me that she's going to build me an Amiga one day. So we'll see.
Oh, how cute. Yeah.
She's awesome. And she's super smart. Maybe one day she'll do it. So that was kind of anything else we need to add. I think that's all we wanted to run through on this episode. We don't want to run too long today. We're kind of feeling sad without Dave here. But right. Did we miss anything, Chris? Britt? I don't see anything brewing anymore. I think we caught up on everything that was in there.
Craig says, aw.
Yeah, Craig says
aw. Craig, we'll probably have to thank Craig in a few weeks because he's going to loan us something for a really cool review. We've got the wheels in motion on that. But yeah, for now, I think we're gonna wrap up this episode. We're going to make this one sort of shorter and sweeter than some of the previous ones. If you liked what you just watched, make sure that you subscribe and get those notifications when we post videos and go live. Dave especially does some really high quality video reviews of lots of the stuff that we cover on the site. There's a lot more on the channel over and above just the podcast, even though I think the podcast is fun. Definitely subscribe. If you like what you see, come by hothardware.com because we've talked about a small fraction of the tech news that we post. Lots more articles, lots more news posted every single day, and you know, vibrant chats going on too. So if you want to, you know, communicate, make some friends with some like-minded folks that love tech, we have all that going on as well. We are on Facebook, facebook.com/hothardware, twitter.com/hothardware. We're on Google Plus too, but I don't think anybody uses that anymore. So yeah,
I do.
Oh, you do? All right. Chris still uses it. So cool.
We're on Instagram.
Yep.
Oh, Instagram. And we're on Instagram as well. That's right. And yeah, a lot of the good picks were from Chris because he takes his time to compose a shot, not like yours truly.
Yeah. JDT, I see you in the chat saying, dang, you missed the comments on the Asus 4K. This will be a VOD. So in a few hours, I think you should see
this whole
thing up on the channel. You can scrub back to where you want and check out that beautiful, beautiful monitor. Just beautiful.
Yes.
Anyways, back to you, Marco.
Yeah, so yeah, gorgeous display. Come by the site, check that out. And I think that is going to be it. Thanks for watching. Peace, everybody.
All right.